This is Playing with Fire. He's at the 20, the 10, the 5. Touchdown!
3 seconds remaining. 2-1. Shots up. It's good!
Here's the pitch, the swing. It's a long fly ball. It's going, going. It's gone! Revealing the secrets of the elite athlete. But be careful. You're playing with fire.
This week, an interview with the former chairman of the U.S. Olympic Committee's Sports Medicine Committee, Dr. Dave Joyner. Music from Jeff Bird, performance enhancement tips, and more.
Freestyle. Welcome, everybody. This is Dr. Bill. I think we have a great show lined up for today. Today, you know, it just emphasizes to me again the importance of the whole idea of sport and virtue and what we're doing with this podcast, Playing with Fire. You know, you look at the kind of the March Madness stuff that goes on at this time of year. You know, you look at fan behavior and, you know, one thing that really bothers me to some degree is, you know, the whole fan thing focusing on the negatives. I don't know how we got there, but, you know, it's, you know, we either pick out physical attributes of people and then we sort of play on those, you know, so we try to find some negative physical attribute and then you hear people chanting or cheering or, you know, jeering about those kinds of things. And, you know, that really bothers me. I don't know why we just don't, you know, put together some powerful kind of cheers that really help pump up our team or who we're trying to support and get them fired up rather than, you know, focus on the negatives of other people. I mean, I competed at a world-class level, and I can tell you it never fired me up to hear people chanting negatively about somebody else. I'd rather hear them chanting for me in a real positive way. I mean, and sometimes I have to almost be careful when I was competing because if people were suddenly, you know, clapping for you, you know, out at the Olympic trials in 1980 in Eugene, Oregon, I remember, you know, every step you took as you ran in on your approach, the whole crowd would clap. You know, it'd be like, I mean, that gets you fired up. You almost have to control yourself so you don't get too, like, over the top. So I hope that we can find a way to, you know, even as fans, as we really enjoy sport, find a more positive way to support the people that we really, you know, want to see do well. I'd also like your advice, if you could send it to me on our listener line or on the website, you know, feedback at reclaimthedame.com. You know, the blog, the website, it's all starting to come together, and we should be there, I think, probably in another week or so. But, you know, give me your thoughts on how things are progressing and what you'd like to see there. So let's get right to the show. Listen up.
Well, welcome, everybody. Today I have a real special guest. His name is Dr. David Joyner. He's an orthopedic surgeon. And just to give you a little bit of his background, which, again, I could probably talk for 5 minutes on his background, it's really extraordinary. He was an All-American at Penn State in both football and wrestling. He was on the Cotton Bowl champion team. What year was that, Dave?
That was the 1972 Cotton Bowl.
1972 Cotton Bowl, captain of the team at Penn State, played pro football for a short stint, has been chairman of the U.S. Olympic Committee Sports Medicine Committee, which he's still affiliated with. He's also a medical logistics consultant, and Dave is just a remarkable guy who's done so many things, and I'm just so happy you could be on the show with us today.
Well, thanks, Bill. It's always great to talk to you, and I'm very happy to be here.
Well, you know, the essence of this podcast, this show, is really trying to look at world-class performance as it relates to virtue, you know, this idea that somehow the two aren't compatible. And, you know, you have such a remarkable background of, you know, performing athletically at, you know, the highest levels. You've seen it from the sports medicine side, dealing with, you know, the drug committee as well on the sports medicine Olympic committee thing. Tell me just your thoughts on the whole idea of sport as it relates to virtue, like your thoughts on it.
Well, my thought always has been, Bill, and still is, about sport and virtue, that what value is sport to the world unless it is a venue to promote and expand virtue. I mean, sport in and of itself, I mean, the ancient Greeks, if you look, it was meant to expand the person. You know, it was meant to expand your horizons and learn about yourself as an educational tool. And there are aspects to sport that are entertainment, obviously, you know, professional athletics, et cetera. And, you know, and so it certainly has a large entertainment industry. But other than a recreational release for the spectator, my firm belief is that the true value in sport is to promote the education and the strength of the individual from within. And if it doesn't do that, and if we don't view it that way, then in my view, the value of sport is either absent or very much diminished.
And, you know, I just thought of one other thing that I didn't mention in the intro to you. You have, like, multiple level black belts in various martial arts forms, you know, one being
right.
Kendo.
Correct.
And I know that just from having spoken with you over the years, you know, the whole idea of Kendo, you know, which maybe you could describe just very briefly, but, you know, the idea of the mental discipline and the idea of virtue and maybe how it fits into that.
Sure. I am a... you know, an instructor in Kendo as well as, you know, Okinawan karate and some other things, and been doing this for 20 plus years. And Kendo is the study of the Japanese art of fencing, or, you know, the samurai sword. But most important in Kendo is really your spiritual development, in that you learn about yourself from the inside out. And, you know, to sum up what takes a lifetime to study, Kendo really teaches you, if you listen and you are a good student, that, you know, in a sense, in the old days, and I don't mean to talk about life and death, but it comes from the battleground, and death is not something that should be sought, but it's to die honorably. If you are going to die, and to fight honorably is really the underlying virtue of conflict. And so everything about Kendo is about respect and honor and doing things in a way that, is more about the proper form rather than about winning. And so really, maybe in a quick summary, is it you know, to lose in battle by fighting inappropriately, and not adhering to the rigors of respect and honor is really to lose. And so it was better to die and fight well than it was to live and fight inappropriately.
Well, that's interesting, because that's really good. And I think that kind of almost segues to my next question for you, which is, you know, sport very much sometimes is portrayed as a battle. You know, people are out there battling and fighting and so forth. And unfortunately today, it seems, especially at the pro level, you know, vice has taken over, you know, pride, anger, sloth, you know, you go through the list of things. And I'm just wondering, why do you think there's so much of that today? Why are there so many of these bad habits being exemplified as opposed to what you're describing?
Well, I think this is my personal thoughts, that certainly there is virtue, and you find it in all aspects, and, you know, in the professional sport world as well. But when the non-virtuous behavior that we do see occurs, I've got to believe that it gets back to, as you mentioned, some things: pride, you know, power. Money is power, and you know, the you know, what is it? You know, power corrupts completely. You know, absolute power
right.
corrupts absolutely. And money in our society, you know, it does get, you know, equated to power. And so I have to believe that, you know, underlying a lot of this is the temptation that exists, and the envy that exists if I don't make more money than you. And so it all fits into, you know, success. Maybe it's really the definition of success. You know, and maybe some athletes, professionally as well as amateur, you know, define success as winning on the scoreboard, which equates to bigger salary. And therefore, you know, that's truly the definition of success rather than winning honorably. You know,
right.
Going back
and
to the Kendo ideal, you know, if you conduct yourself inappropriately and still live, you've really lost.
Right.
And so instead of just it's the W on the board that matters no matter how you get there, maybe that's been redefined in some people's minds as the true definition of success.
What's hot? You know, I was watching a movie again for a second time. It was called Cinderella Man. And this came out, I'm thinking maybe it was a couple of years ago. I'm not really positive of the date that it came out. But it's a great movie. It's one of the best boxing movies I've ever seen. Most inspirational, I guess, one because it's a true story, but also because of the, you know, the content of the story. And I think it was one of these movies that somehow got missed by most people. So I don't know how many of you saw Cinderella Man, but I would recommend it to you. It's a story about a fighter, James J. Braddock, and he was called the, I think it was New Jersey Bulldog. He had like 10 wins, and he just looked like he was going to be one of these guys that was going to give him a shot, you know, at the title at some point. And then the Great Depression hit. And when it did, you know, obviously the economy went through the ground, and, you know, he didn't have enough to eat. He had a family. I believe he had like 5 children. And he began to struggle, and he had a few injuries. And due to the injuries and so forth, he ended up losing his ability to fight, and a number of things happened where, you know, it's one of the few movies, too, that I really got a sense of the depression, you know, really what people were struggling with and what they had to go through, and it was really horrific. It was just really incredible. And yet, at the same time, he loves his wife, he loves his children. Despite these struggles, you know, they keep working, and you see this perseverance, and again, you talk about virtue, you know, you see the virtue there. It's really incredible. And he finally, you know, he's at the pits, he's at the bottom, he's actually, you know, begging people, you know, with his hat in hand for money, and, you know, just, it's a very emotional, you know, movie. He gets this one opportunity to fight a guy who's going to be a contender for the title, and it's one of these things where it's almost like he's supposed to go in, and he's old, and he's just going to get beat up, and basically give the guy, you know, his one more win so that he moves on to be the next contender. It was just really to fill another fight slot. Well, as it turns out, he ends up winning that fight, and kind of in a dramatic way, and people start to say, hey, what's going on, you know, this old guy who basically can't fight anymore, and when I say old, you know, it was old for boxing, and I'm not going to give you the whole story, but I'll just tell you that it is one of the most inspiring, you know, movies I've ever seen, and just, you know, a great story about, you know, a man who, you know, has a deep faith in God, loves his family, does the right thing. You know, just one example, he actually had to go on relief, which was welfare at the time. And this was a very humiliating thing. This was not something that, you know, he wanted to do or anybody really wants to do, I'm sure. And after he had some success towards the end, he actually went back and paid back the money. Went back onto the line, you know, comes up, puts the roll of money back up, and paid back what he had been given. So just a, you know, a really good man. It just struck me as something that more people maybe should have seen. So I'm not going to give you the ending, but it is really just one of these ones that just wells up your eyes, you know, both with tears of joy and sometimes sorrow. But it's a great ending, and I'd recommend it to you all. This is Silver Plated by Jeff Bird.
Hey.
That was Jeff Bird with Silver Plated. You can catch him on GarageBand or just check out our show notes at reclaimthegame.com. It's your call. One of the questions I received this week, someone wanted to know, how do you become a sports psychologist? There's basically two ways or two kind of tracks that you can take. One is the sports science route, which would be more of the sports science, physical education, motor control, human movement side of things. And the other would be more from the clinical psychology standpoint. My own bias, maybe because that's my background, is I think you really need both. And so my background has some counseling psych in it. It has some biomechanics, applied exercise physiology, physical education. It sort of puts all of these things together, including, you know, the counseling psychology side of things. So I'm a licensed psychologist, but I also have the background, on the sports science side. And then I've been very fortunate to have been a coach and an athlete. And so that kind of gives me some insight that maybe not all, you know, everybody would have. But I think that's really what helps you to be most effective at being a sports psychologist, because really what a sports psychologist is trying to do is help an athlete to get all of their skills, talents, and abilities to come to bear at the moment they want them to come out. It's not just a matter of thinking good thoughts. You know, it's a matter of how do I get all my talents out right now? And that's really what hopefully a sports psychologist can help you do. As far as my faith, it is interesting that you bring that part of the question up. Most athletes, when they come to me, at first come with a very specific thing that they want to improve, and it's usually something physical. So I'll get a player who says, I want to improve my 40 time, or, you know, I'm having some difficulty, you know, concentrating on catching or whatever it might be. And I find it very interesting that that's why they come. I evaluate, and again, I'm looking at the whole person, and I may say, yeah, some of that's happening, but that's the byproduct. That's really not the cause. That's really not the root of what you need to work on in order to improve. And so I'll begin to address a number of things with them, and at the same time, as I said to you, we're all, you know, body, mind, and spirit at the same time, and so I'll be working on the spiritual part as well while we're doing some of these other things, whether they be mental and physical. And what slowly happens over time, I would almost say, is that the athletes I've worked with, in the end, it becomes more spiritual direction, if anything, than it does, some of the physical, because that's easy. The physical and mental side of sport, once you know some of these basic kind of things, really is relatively simple. It's a matter of, you know, perseverance, working hard, knowing what you're working at and mastering it. But it's the spiritual part that grounds you and that gives you the ability to sacrifice and some of these other things that we've spoken about in previous episodes. So I would say, too, it's a very important part. I don't see how you could possibly separate it from what I do or what you do if you're interested in going to sports psychology. So hope that answers your question.
Skills and drills.
Everybody wants speed. No matter what sport you're in, speed makes up for a lot of things, and it certainly gives you an advantage if you have it. But almost every sport also times you. It wants to know how fast you are, and so even if it's in football, there's still a 40-yard dash, you know, that they measure your timing. You know, baseball 60. People are looking to see how fast you are, but a sprint is made up of three phases, really. And what I wanted to talk about today is just a couple of, you know, a simple drill for working on the first phase of a sprint start, and that is your start. It's also the area that you lose the most time most quickly, because you're going from 0 miles an hour, you know, you're still, to trying to get your whole body moving and gain momentum quickly to obviously run as fast a time as possible. The thing to keep in mind is that when you look at these times that we're being asked to run, or, you know, that are, you know, our whole lives are, you know, being, you know, weighed upon, you know, if you take some of the guys I worked with, for example, the NFL Combine, tenths of a second are everything. You know, somebody running a tenth faster is, you know, can be the difference between being drafted or not drafted, or being drafted higher and making more money. So this tenth of a second, though, is made such a big deal about, but have you ever thought about a tenth of a second? If I asked you to take out a stopwatch right now and stop and start as fast as you can with just your finger, you can't do it in a tenth of a second. It's going to take you probably closer to 0.3 seconds. And yet, you know, here whole careers and, you know, whole lives are being measured, and, you know, we're winning and dying by, you know, did we run how fast was our 40 time? Well, there's a way to improve upon it. So the good news is you can gain these tenths of a second, but if you're not doing things the right way, you can easily lose tenths of a second as well. What I wanted to talk about specifically was the start. It's a little bit challenging to try to do this, you know, verbally and not be able to show it to you. As they say, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words. I'll try not to give you a thousand words, but let me try to lay this out for you. Let's take a start line. What I'd suggest to you is that you figure out which leg you think is your dominant leg, meaning your stronger leg, and I'd put that leg forward. The other leg would be just slightly behind, meaning your foot, the toe of your back leg, that back foot, would only maybe be right at the heel or maybe a couple of inches behind the heel of your front foot. As far as how far you should be from the starting line itself, well, some of that has to do with your height and so forth. But in general, what you want to be able to do is when you're down in a start position, you want to make sure that your legs aren't too compressed, meaning that if you took your knee joint, you know, that means you're, you know, looking at your femur and your tibia, you know, those two bones, you know, the big bone at the top of your thigh and your tibia is like your calf, you know, what your calf's attached to. If you look at those two bones, they shouldn't be tighter than a 45-degree angle. They should be a 45-degree angle or opened a little bit more than that. That's the best position or optimal position to be in. So when you're touching the line, you want to feel that your legs are really in a position ready just to explode you forward. As far as your hand on the line, if you know, in football, your 40-yard, they only let you put one hand down. It's usually a three-point start as opposed to track, which would be two hands down. Let's just take the football start. One hand is kind of, you know, cocked back, your elbow's cocked back behind you, ready to go into a, you know, arm running motion. The hand that's on the line, what you want to do is have your head and shoulder actually be out a little bit over your hand. It's a little bit of an uncomfortable position because you kind of feel like you're leaning out, like you're almost going to fall. And so you have to be, you can't be too far leaning out, but at the same time, you want to be enough that you kind of really just feel this forward motion. A start should almost feel, if it's done well, like you're going to fall on your face. You almost feel you can't get your feet moving fast enough because they're kind of behind you, and you almost can't get them up fast enough underneath you, and you almost feel a sensation of falling forward. That's ideal. That's a great start. I'm going to give you a drill that's going to help you master that feeling. You can get some mats, whether you have a high jump mat around or, at the school that you might be at, or if you can find some mats maybe at a gymnastic center or whatever you might be around you. You don't need a lot because you're not jumping from a high height. But what I'd recommend to you is you got to go out to a high jump apron, put down a mark, set yourself up like I just described. Set the mark, by the way, from the pit, maybe, 3 feet away from the pit. And what you're going to do is not run. What you're going to do is, in a sense, jump straight out. Not up. You're going to jump straight out at like a 45-degree angle until your whole body is completely straight in the air. And literally, it's like you're diving head first. You're going to land on your mat, on your chest, and your stomach. So that's what you want to work on. The idea here is to push off of both legs. Often with starts, most people push off only one leg. As a matter of fact, it's usually the leg that's closest to the line. The leg that was back a little bit further really doesn't do much pushing. It's almost pulled off the ground immediately to take the first step. The problem with that is, one, you lose half your power as you're pushing off this start. And the second is, it tends to get you to stand upright too soon. So as soon as you pull that leg out quickly out in front of you, it tends to force you into a more upright position. So in the beginning of a start, first 2 or 3 steps is really going to be kind of uncomfortable. You're going to feel like I'm almost going to fall because your feet are driving behind your center of gravity, behind your hips. So what I'd suggest is, again, explode out into the mat a few times, where you're coming out this 45-degree angle. Once this is comfortable, move the line back so that now you'll get 1 foot down before you explode into the mat. And then eventually, once you get that feeling down, you can move it back and get 2 steps in and then 3 steps in. And it'll give you a great sensation and yet have the comfort and security of knowing you're not going to fall on your face until you can get the feel of doing it without the mat. Iron Will. We've talked before about there's reasons why this peak performance stuff doesn't happen. Things get in our way. And so I sometimes have a way of demonstrating that to a group of people. I'll try to do this again, sort of verbally describe this to you. But what I'll do is, if I'm giving a talk someplace, I'll I'll get a roll of like masking tape, and I'll be on like a stage or something, you know, and I'll ask for a volunteer to come up, and I usually have them go to one end of the stage, hold the end of the tape, I roll the whole thing out, you know, stretching it all the way back as far as I can go, and then I say, okay, put it down. We put down as a straight line. I then go back to them, give them another piece to hold. I then stretch the thing back out, and I said, you know, now put that down about it, like, you know, maybe foot, you know, parallel to that line. And so we put that down, and then I come and I put lines across, you know, the ends. And I said, okay, now I take out a dollar out of my pocket, and I put down a dollar at one end opposite of where that person's now standing. And I said, now, okay, you ready? And kind of people look a little apprehensive, like, you know, what am I going to ask them to do here? You know, are they going to have to leap down there or what? And I said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to walk down between the tape. I want you to pick up the dollar, and that's it. And they sort of look at me, you know, like, you know, are you going to do something to me or what? And I said, no, just walk down and pick up the dollar. And so they kind of look at me and shrug their shoulders usually. And then they walk down the beam and they pick up the dollar and they get at the end. And it's kind of funny. I've had people walk back to me or, you know, just step off. And I'll say, okay. I said, now go sit down. And they kind of look and put the dollar in their pocket and walk back to their seat. And, you know, everybody kind of laughs and they kind of look, you know, in a kind of a strange way, like, what's that about? And I'll say to the guy that, or the woman, you know, who just did the exercise with me, I'll say, let me ask you this first. I said, how hard was that? And they look at me and they say, well, you know, it was easy. And I mean, I said to them, was it ridiculously easy? And they said, yeah. You know, and people sometimes laugh because I said, well, see, you should have volunteered, you know. And it was easy. It was a very simple thing to do. I said, but now what if I took that same, and what I describe it as a beam. You know, I said, I can't carry a beam with me that size. But, you know, if I took that same beam, and I'm from New York, so I used to use the analogy of the World Trade Centers. Unfortunately, you know, those are no longer there. But I used to say, you know, what if I took this beam now and I stretched it out between the World Trade Centers? I put down the dollar on one side, and I said, just walk over there and pick it up. And almost everybody looks at me and says, no way. You know, what, you think I'm crazy? I'm not going over there for a dollar. Maybe a big pile of money, I might think about it, but I'm not going over there for a dollar. And I say, why not? And they say, well, what do you mean? I could fall off and get killed. You know, they look over this edge and they can see the little cars and people down there. You know, and they say, you know, I'm not going over there for a dollar. It's not worth my life. But let's just look at this for a second. The same beam, let's say it's the same exact conditions. Was there any problem going across the beam and picking up the dollar when I first had it here on the stage on the floor? No, none. Matter of fact, without the person realizing it, what they did is they put their whole 100% into doing just really two things, which was seeing the beam and feeling their body, left, right, left, right, left, right, all the way across the beam, bend over, see the dollar, put your fingers around it, step off. On top of the World Trade Center, though, what happens is you still have 100% to give, but the difference now is instead of the 100% being focused on seeing the beam and feeling your body left, right, all the way across, you almost put the whole 100% on the unbelievable consequence, or the final consequence is that if I fall off this thing, I'm going to get killed. Which means even if you attempted it, there'd be a good chance you would fall off because you're actually not focused on walking on the beam. And very often in athletics, we do the same thing. This is why peak performance doesn't come out, is because instead of putting the 100% on the task at hand, what we're doing, we tend to put it on the consequence. And so the little, you know, analogy I'm giving you here is to stay focused on the task at hand, to put the full attention that you have on what it takes to actually perform the thing that you're doing at the moment. The consequences can only take away that 100% that you have or percentages of it, which then lead you to actually the outcome you don't want, which is either maybe not making a shot or not making a play or falling off the beam. So I hope this will be of some help to you.
Soul food.
You know, all of us face adversity, and there's a great print I have in my office by Britton Riviere, R-I-V-I-E-R-E, and it's a print, a pen and ink that he did of Daniel in the Lion's Den, and it's just really an awesome picture. I don't know why, but I'm drawn into the picture when you look at it, and it's Daniel looking up into this light, and he has his hands folded behind his back, and you see these lions, you know, kind of circling, and they're looking up at the light too, and there's just this incredible sense of faith and hope and really trust. And as we all face adversity in our lives, this is a kind of picture that just helps us, I think, inspire us. And just as the little phrase below is, you know, Daniel 6:22, my God has sent his angel and he has shut the lions' mouths and they have not hurt me. thanks for being part of the show today. It was really great. I'm looking forward to your continued feedback. Call our listener comment line at 206-203-1301. Again, 206-203-1301. Or write me at feedback@reclaimthegame.com. And I'll look forward to being with you again real soon. Take care and God bless.